Welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I am your host, Greg, and Ronak is back in the office today. Today, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite topics, Jeppy, and Ronak's own personal strategy to beat Jeppy. Ronak, how you doing? How was your flight back home?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back in Philadelphia. The allergies are a little bit better in Philadelphia compared to California. So overall, I'm feeling good. How about you, Greg? How are you doing this week?
Not bad. Just had some lunch and it's a beautiful day outside. It's been a beautiful week actually in Philadelphia. All right. So today's topic really goes back to some conversations that Ronak and I have had personally in the office, just talking. And we talk a lot about finance. We talk a lot about wealth generation. And one of the strategies that he came across and one of the ETFs that he came across was this JEPI, which is the JP Morgan high yield distribution / dividend producing ETF. Which we've talked about on this podcast a little bit. I put a fair amount of money into that. And a little bit of my strategy is to put some money into JEPI and really wait out a little bit of this kind of bouncing along the bottom of the economy, what you're seeing with the S&P, although today's been a pretty good day for the market. And the reason that I wanted to talk about this was you as an individual can actually take and do what JEPI and JP Morgan is doing. And you can do it in a way that actually gives you a much, much higher yield overall. And I really just wanted to pick Ronak's brain about this because he's starting to actively trade options and things like that with that kind of strategy in mind of how do I use compounding interest. But overall, Ronak, give us a little bit of a rundown of what is JEPI first to lay the foundation of what they're doing. And then ultimately, what is your strategy with trying to replicate what they're doing, but at a much higher level?
Yeah, so JEPI is an interesting ETF. So again, it's by JP Morgan. It's a managed fund. So basically what's happening is they're buying a whole bunch of different stocks of well-known companies, everything from Hershey's to Pepsi. And what they're also doing is selling what's called call options to offset those stock investments. So let's start real quick with what a call option is. A call option is basically the right to buy a share of a certain stock at a certain time at a certain price. So let's say you're looking at Pepsi and you buy a call option for $100, right? So if, and let's say this call option is for 1 month, that means at the end of 1 month, if the value of Pepsi stock is below $100, then basically nothing happens. If it's above $100, you have the ability to go buy that stock at $100, even though it's trading at higher than $100 at the end of the month. It's like a little bit of a gamble that you're setting a price saying that I think the price is going to be above X or Y or whatever is the price, and you're willing to pay a little bit less than that. And if you're correct, you can buy the price at a cheaper value. If you're wrong, nothing happens. No transaction takes place. In order to engage in this, you have to pay a little bit of fee upfront. Now, what selling does is you can basically sell this opportunity to other people and collect a little bit of premium, right? So let's say today I own one share of Pepsi and I think maybe it might go down over time. So I sell somebody else the opportunity to buy that share of Pepsi at whatever price we set, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months into the future, whatever it is. And for that option that I'm giving that other person, they might pay me, let's say 40 cents, right? It's a nice way for me to generate a little bit of income aside from the normal dividend payouts that get paid through regular stock ownership. And this tends to be a very efficient marketplace where the odds that the stock is going to trade higher than that strike price, you don't really know, and you're compensated accordingly, right? So if there's a very high likelihood that the stock is going to do very well and be worth more than that strike price, then the compensation that I should be getting to sell this option to somebody else should be higher. So maybe 80 cents instead of 40 cents. But if there's a very low probability, then maybe I should only be compensated for 10 cents in selling this option to somebody else. So it is a little bit more complicated of a strategy. It's not for everyone. I think in general, options trading is a very risky thing, and I actually would not advise most people doing it just because you can trip yourself up quite a bit. But I think it is important to learn from this that there's other ways to generate income other than buying and selling stock, other than holding for dividend payments and other than bonds, right? There can be more creative ways to generate an income stream for yourself. And what JEPI does, it packages that in a very nice way for somebody that's not too experienced with options trading can still get a lot of the benefits, right? There are some people that can benefit from having a higher income and are not looking for capital appreciation. So that's where JEPI comes into play. I think right now they're yielding something like 11%, which is quite a bit, almost 1% per month. That's an amazing distribution that's coming to you as the investor. And when you look at JEPI from a more macro standpoint, I think what this generally means is that in a down market, your yield is going to help cushion stocks going down quite a bit. And in an up market, JEPI, the value of the ticker probably won't go up as much as the stock market. So there is a very clear argument to be made to just own a simple index fund over something like JEPI, unless somebody is looking for that income. And I don't think it's fair to say that everybody should just blindly go into S&P 500 index funds. People have different needs, different goals for their finances. And if somebody is looking for income generation, this is an interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, so for me personally, I actually had a fair amount before I heard about JEPI in the high yield S&P 500 index, which is the ticker symbol is SPHD. And I think that was getting like 2.7 or 3.0% dividend yield. And then when we started talking about JEPI, I was like, oh man, you can get, I think it's actually 11.69 or 11.7% yield, which again is not coming from necessarily all dividends. It's coming mostly from the options trading that the JP Morgan folks are doing within that JEPI ETF. And for me, it was like, I don't know exactly what's going to go on with the economy over the next couple of years. It could still go, it might go up, and then it might go right back down 3 or 4%. And something like JEPI is a way that I felt I could hedge against that a little bit by, it looks like we'll get around 11%. Maybe that's a little bit lower. Maybe that's a little bit higher as we go. But it does give you a nice amount of yield on whatever capital you have in there. And for us, my goal with the JEPI account is, again, we've talked about the buy, borrow, die stuff. So we ended up taking out basically a loan against our brokerage account to buy one of the rental houses. And just with JEPI, the amount that I have in there right now, which is, I don't know, maybe 10% of my portfolio or something like that, is paying that interest rate on the loan, which is great. So it's basically like I'm getting that loan for free, but I'm also getting the tax advantages of paying an interest rate on a loan rather than me having to sell my stock. And so that's the reason that I decided to go with JEPI was I want a way to get a higher yield without doing the active stuff that Ronak, I think, is going to talk a little bit about next. So it is something interesting. Do your own research. Again, this is not financial advice. It's really for financial education. But this is one of those things that if you're interested in building up income, it's also completely passive, right? Like we talk about short-term rentals and things like that that are supposedly passive income. This is actually passive income. There's literally nothing that you're doing. You're not actively trading anything. You just have the money in the JEPI account. And come the first of every month, you get whatever that distribution is directly into your account as a cash payment. It's great. It is taxed at ordinary income levels. I think dividends, are dividends taxed actually at ordinary income levels, Ronak?
So it's partly ordinary income tax and partly capital gains tax rate, the distribution. The dividends are taxed at the long-term capital gains rate, and then the call options are taxed at the short-term rate. So basically, I would probably say around 75% of the distribution is taxed at the higher rate, and about 25% is taxed at the lower rate. So if you have the opportunity to buy this through a Roth 401k or Roth IRA account or some sort of tax-efficient vehicle, that actually ends up being a lot more interesting than a normal brokerage account. But that's not to say this is a bad investment for a normal brokerage account. The other thing that I would add is that the expense ratio on JEPI specifically is 0.35, which is actually quite a bit lower than several other covered call option ETFs that are out there. As we learned in our fees compounding episode, any way that you can lower the fees is a good thing because this stuff really does add up over time. So definitely do your own homework, but 0.35% isn't that bad. My personal normal threshold is 0.5%. Anything more than that, I'm really starting to get pretty worried. So this is below that, which is good.
So I keep saying JEPI, but I want to make sure that everybody knows exactly what that is. So the ticker symbol is JEPI for anybody that wants to do more research on it. So I guess, Ronak, the next thing I want to jump into is, okay, you read a lot about JEPI. I ended up putting capital into JEPI. You did not. So what are you doing instead of a JEPI strategy? Because I know that you're doing some amount of options trading to diversify your own portfolio. So can you give us as much color as you would like to around the strategy that you're taking and how it's going so far?
Yeah, so earlier on, I used to work at a hedge fund where I specifically made mathematical algorithms to understand stock market movements and financial derivatives and options and how they should be priced and when they're mispriced. And one thing that I thought was really interesting is we're talking about that call option contract, right? One person giving another person the right to buy a stock at a certain price at a specific date. There's an inherent volatility that's built into the calculation for how that option should be priced. So for example, if you have a stock that's moving very rapidly up and down, right? That's going to cost more to buy that option because there's the potential that stock can move way past that strike price or that agreed upon price, right? But if you have a very slow moving stock, very predictable, then there's a less likelihood that strike price is going to be hit. So the premium that would be collected is smaller. So that's the volatility. But one thing that's really interesting that we saw was that the shorter the time frame, the higher the expected volatility, and the longer the time frame, the lower expected volatility. So what does that mean? That means basically if you try to guess what the stock price is going to be of any company on a Monday and try to guess it for the next Friday, that's probably going to be a little bit more difficult than trying to guess what it's going to be 3 months from now. You can be more a little bit more predictable. That's how the options market is at least pricing this stuff. So because of that, the premium that you collect when you're selling these options are actually much higher the shorter term, the duration of these contracts. So what JEPI specifically is doing is they're selling 1 month call options. So again, they're buying some Pepsi stock and then they're selling the right to somebody else to buy that Pepsi stock 1 month from now if the price of Pepsi stock is above or below a certain value. What I wanted to do on my own was I don't want to go out 1 month. I want to do this on a weekly level. And what that resulted in was a significantly higher percentage yield. It definitely is more risk, right? So if tomorrow an earnings report comes out and a stock drops by 10%, you know, that's going to be a much bigger hit than if you are selling a 1 month contract. But I do like that control of being able to, one, write the contracts myself, two, pick all the underlying stocks myself, and then three, get to pick the duration. So by going down to 1 week instead of 1 month, the yield essentially gets cut in half, but it's on a 1/4 time frame. So it's almost more than a 2x on the potential yield that you can get from this. And this is looking at pretty conservative stocks. I've been looking at companies like American Express, Berkshire Hathaway, the Dow Jones Industrial ETF, relatively boring things, nothing crazy like a Peloton stock or anything like that. And the rate of return that we're looking at is something between 30 and 40%, which is fantastic. Again, there is a lot of risk associated with this, but honestly, I'm just looking to pay my rent every month and that's about it. And this has been a pretty seamless method so far.
Yeah, so let's talk about a little bit more of the practical side. So if somebody wanted to learn more about this, I know that you use Yahoo Finance to find what these call options look like, which typically in the world today, you don't usually use Yahoo for too much. Any practical advice you can give somebody that's, hey, interested, maybe they've done it in the past before, like what are the sources of information that you're looking into when you're deciding to do which call options each week? Like how do you actually structure that? Is that like Monday morning, you come online, you look at Yahoo Finance and see which ones you're going to buy, or do you set it up the Friday before? What are the practical actual aspects of this?
Yeah, so basically options expire essentially every Friday. And so in order to do 1 week options, I typically log on very early Monday morning, take a look at what the different option prices are for these companies that I know extremely well. I have my own idea of what their valuation should be. And then if there is any sort of gap or there is an abnormally high premium that somebody is willing to offer me to buy an options contract, I'll go ahead and sell it. So from an academic standpoint, there is what's called the Black-Scholes model. So there were two economists that end up winning a Nobel Prize for this, which basically tries to price what the premium should be on options contracts. This is a very theoretical exercise. I don't think it hasn't really impacted the pricing of how these things take place. I think this is a little bit more of an art than a science. If somebody did want to go down the science side of it, I would suggest taking a look at the Black-Scholes formula. That's statistically how this stuff should be. But what I like to do is more just see, is there any sort of outlier, right? Is somebody willing to pay an abnormal price for a premium on a call option? And if so, I'll swoop in and sell it to them. If not, I'll just pass for that week. That's one thing that I did like over the JEPI, where it just automatically does this every single month. And that's what the fund does. They're not being a little bit targeted. They're not saying, okay, let's skip this month just because we don't see an opportunity, or let's double down on a second month if we see more opportunities than we were expecting.
The other fun thing that I was doing with Ronak was looking at basically the interest that he's getting on potentially selling options and doing this options trading. And just for fun, to pull up the compounding interest calculator, because it's my favorite calculator in the world, I inputted initial investment $50,000 and length of time in years. This is a little bit too long, but we're going to say 30 years. So if you're doing weekly trades or weekly options trading for 30 straight years, and we're going to say that your average estimated interest rate, Ronak, 30, what do you think, 30%? Let's say if you're doing this weekly, is that appropriate? Okay. So that ends up being, after 30 years of doing that, starting with just the initial 50,000, nothing else that you're contributing monthly. Actually, Ronak, do you want to guess? I'm going to bring you back here. You want to guess?
30%, I don't know, maybe $5 million.
30 years compounding at a 30% interest rate, starting with a base of $50,000, you would hit $130 million, $999,782.18. So just about $131 million. Again, that would be extremely fantastic for anybody, right? To do weekly trading or weekly options trading 52 weeks a year for 30 different years doing it. So let's just have a little bit of fun with the calculator. Let's lower that to let's say you do it for 5 years. And you're still getting that 30% interest. You know, for 5 years, starting with 50, you would get up to $185,646. Yeah, it's not too bad.
Ed, the thing that I would really emphasize here is that I do my own value investing, right? The companies that I'm doing this on, I have my idea of what their true intrinsic value is. So if the underlying share price falls, I'm comfortable holding on to these shares. I'm not going to buy the shares at a ridiculously high price that I don't feel comfortable with. So even for whatever reason, if the call option strategy completely goes haywire and doesn't work, I'm not holding the bag on a bad investment. I think that's the key to keep me relatively calm with all of this, that at the end of the day, I want the stocks that I'm doing the strategy on. It's just I'm trying to layer on that income level on top of it. And the ultimate risk here is you lose if the underlying stocks that you're buying end up going to zero, that's the most that you could possibly lose. So if you are picking those wild companies that just sway up and down very dramatically, a lot of times those are the companies that have the highest risk. The companies that I'm looking at are quite stable, probably going to be around for another 50 years. And the valuation that they're trading out today, I think, is pretty reasonable.
So it was actually a formula I was using was for annual compounding. So I'm going to go ahead and change that to, let's see if I can do weekly. So you're making how much, let's say on average a week? How much?
Oh, per week? Per week. Let's say 0.75% per week.
All right. So starting with 50,000 for 0.75%, And again, let's just do the 30 years for now. Additional deposits, none. Compound interval. So that would be weekly, right? You'd be compounding weekly, yeah? All right, so calculate. All right. All right, so this is fun. So 30-year projection, if you're compounding at 0.75% weekly with no other deposits into the account, that's $5.7 billion.
Is that
that is insane. All right, so let's just bring that down to 10 years again. So we'll keep this calculation in since we actually did it correctly on this one. So compounding again weekly with Ronax options trading, if he's averaging 0.75% interest rate weekly for 10 years, starting with a $50,000 initial investment, in 10 years time, you would have just over $2.4 million. So again, if you haven't played with a compounding interest calculator, you need to just pull up Google, go find one. This one I'm using there's a government compounding interest calculator. That one doesn't have weekly compounding, so I actually switched to a different one. But if you haven't done this, you need to go and do this. Especially if you have money just sitting like a savings account that's not yielding anything, realize how much money you were just wasting just sitting there without yielding anything. These are fun calculations to make, again, just because you start to understand. I was listening to I can't remember which podcast it was, but humans don't think in exponentials. They think in a lot more linear growth. This is not linear growth, right? Compounding interest is an exponentially growing algorithm, basically. So go play with these calculators and start to figure out, holy crap, if I start saving right now this much money, even if just throwing it in JEPI, like 11% growth a year is fantastic. Ronak is shooting for more like 30 to 40% a year with his options trading. But you need to go play with these calculators to start to understand what does exponential growth look like.
A couple of thoughts to end with here also. One, again, options trading is pretty complicated. I personally worked at a hedge fund, wrote mathematical algorithms that had many millions of dollars running through them. I would not advise most people to actually be buying and selling option contracts themselves without doing your proper homework. Going with something like a JEPI is a much safer way where you're not going to accidentally make some big mistake. At the same time, I think it's also important to do your homework on, do you care about income or do you just want upside capital appreciation? Everybody's situation is going to be a little bit different. And then I think that there's just to know that the finance world, you can be creative in it. We're all told index funds and bonds are the best ways to go. And maybe if you want to dabble a little bit in individual companies, that's great. We've been talking about angel investing on this podcast and getting out completely outsized returns. We're talking about call options here where one can also get very outstanding rewards over time. There's different ways to build a financial future that can compound quite a bit over time. This is an interesting one that probably most people don't pay any attention to. And I think it's worth at least spending an hour or two learning about covered calls and what that means. Especially when I was working back at Facebook, people were being compensated in Facebook stock. And a lot of times people did not want to sell that Facebook stock. And a nice way that you can generate income off of that stock to pay for your daily expenses or whatever it is, because Facebook didn't pay a dividend, is actually writing covered calls. This is just a different strategy that's out there. It's not right for everybody, but it's worthwhile checking to see if it's right for you.
The last thing that we'll end on, Ronak, do you remember the name of it was either a hedge fund or some kind of banking thing that makes like ridiculous annual returns and they charge a ton of fees. But what was that and what were the returns?
This was the Medallion Fund. This was started, I think, back in the 1980s. It's a group of maybe 300 mathematical PhDs at this point. They've been generating returns at some crazy level, something like 65% compounded year over year, over 30 years at this point. They've never had a losing year before. After the first couple years that the fund got started, they stopped taking any sort of outside investment. And in order to invest in this company, you have to be an employee, which basically means you have to be a mathematical PhD and at the complete top of your game, because they're only going to hire the best of the best. But if you think about that for a second, a 65% compounded return over the last 40 years, these numbers get absolutely silly. But the interesting thing to remember here is that this strategy that they use, as well as the covered call strategy, it can't scale infinitely, right? You can make you can have an easier time turning $100 into $200 than turning $100 million into $200 million, right? In all of this, you're looking for those opportunities and taking advantage of them, but there's not an infinite amount of opportunities. Greg, I'm sure you're plugging this into the compound interest calculator right now, what 65% interest does over the next 40 years. But again, the problem is you can't go with infinite money, right? So even if the compound interest calculator shows $100 billion or whatever it is, that's not actually realistic. That's why the fund stopped accepting investments, is because the strategy stopped working if they try to throw too much money at it.
Which is an interesting thing. Venture capital firms, tying this back to like angel investing in venture capital, people think that there's a certain size of a venture capital firm that's the ideal size, where if you're making early stage bets, so people say 150 to 200 million is a sweet spot for venture capital firms because you can make a very nice return on that amount of capital. But it's also like you can only make so many bets within each fund. Somebody that raises a $1 billion fund, if you're doing early stage, that means you're potentially making hundreds of investments, which that's fine if you're not going to add value necessarily. If you're just like a Tiger Global that says, we're going to give you the highest valuation, we're just going to throw in $10 million into your seed round and you'll never hear from us again, versus somebody like a Benchmark, which keeps their fund to a relatively normal size. They only have six partners. It's an equal partnership. And that, I think, is the more advantageous strategy than raising a gigantic fund. That's got to also just be hard to track. Like, people raise gigantic funds because they can charge management fees and create these basically like mini fiefdoms where they can hire a bunch of people that can help with their portfolio companies. But for like a venture capital firm like a Benchmark, where there's really just a handful of people that actually work there and they actually work with their portfolio companies to make sure they grow and scale, I think that's the much more interesting thing instead of having a huge, gigantic venture arm. Anyways, I did do that calculation. So if you started with 50,000 and you're compounding annually for 30 years at a 60% annual interest rate, that comes out to $66 billion. There you go. So I think we'll end on that. Ronak, thank you for the knowledge bomb. That was a lot of fun. And again, we'll drop some links into the show notes with a couple compounding interest calculators. I'll put that Medallion Bank in there. Anything else that we mentioned in the show, Black-Scholes formula, we'll put that in there. And then maybe if Ronak has some like good YouTube channels or something else that we can throw in there, we'll throw that in as well. Again, if you find this content helpful, useful, please give us some ratings on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Follow us, get those automatic downloads, tell your friends. Like, that's another big thing. We have a bunch of physicians listening to the show, and honestly, this has grown a lot faster than either Ronak or I expected it to, which is fantastic. And so if you are out there and you're listening and you're like, hey, some of my colleagues who actually might be interested in some of these things, please share it with them. It's pretty easy to get the link to the Apple Podcasts or Spotify, whatever it is. Send it to some people. It helps us grow. It helps us continue going with a lot of these daily podcasts because, again, it's definitely work still, right? It's fun to do. But yeah, help us grow. Get us out there. Again, if you have any questions or thoughts on different topics that you want us to cover, feel free to reach out to either one of us, Greg or Ronak at physicians.vc. And have a good rest of the day. We'll see you next time on the Physician Syndicate.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast.